All right, so we're getting back into the lectionary this morning, and we're in a time called called the ordinary, which basically just means it's the time between the major Christian festivals in the Christian calendar. And we've been talking about how maybe the Bible and God sees the ordinary time, ordinary things in a different light than we do, maybe placing more importance on the ordinary than we do. And that's a good thing, because the text that we're going to read today is going to make you feel very ordinary. It's basically a list of sort of the greats of faith, people who have had a lot of faith, who have sacrificed a lot, suffered a lot, and accomplished a lot. And the way I want to approach it is just with this simple question of the faith of other people. And do we need to concern ourselves with people of faith, other people of faith? And if we do, what's our role in sort of the larger community of faith? And it's a question that I ask myself basically every day of my life. Do I really need to associate myself with other people of faith? And I think it's a question that's on the mind of the larger culture right now. Gandhi famously said, "I would be a Christian if it wasn't for Christians." And you probably heard in the news a couple weeks ago, Anne Rice very publicly said that she no longer believes in Christianity. She only believes in Christ. And she, of course, is referring to a very specific religious institution. And I just want to ask the broader question this morning. Do we really need to associate with other people of faith? And if we do, what is our role? What purpose does it fulfill? So let's jump into the text. You can read it on the screen or read it with a neighbor, and then we'll go from there. And it's Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 40. So Hebrews is a very powerful book. It's often forgotten. It's near the end of the New Testament. And it was written to a community that I think we can identify with a lot. It was a community that was beginning to doubt, a community that their faith was beginning to fail. It had been a while since anything had happened, since Christ had been resurrected, since the Pentecost. They felt like nothing was happening. They couldn't see anything tangible. And they're beginning to doubt, to lose their faith. And this whole letter is written basically as a long sermon with the intention to encourage the community. And the passage that we just read right now is sort of the crescendo of the letter. It's right before he makes his main point, which is in chapter 12, where he says we need to cast off our burdens and run the race assigned to us. This end of chapter 11 is sort of right when he's at his peak. He's about to make his main point. And how does he make his point? How does he decide to encourage the people? He just starts name dropping. He runs down a list of people who have had faith. And he's kind of making the assumption that people know the backstories behind a lot of these people that he mentions. But I think the point that we can get from that is the only way, the best way that he knows how to encourage people is by offering stories of other people's faith. The best way to strengthen our faith is to hear stories of other people's faith, to hear the history of our faith. And he's saying without those stories, without that context, your faith is not sustainable. Your faith is going to die. I think a good way to illustrate this is with the picture of the American suburb, the suburban house. You know, when they first started building suburbs maybe 150 years ago, they kind of, it came with a big promise, a great promise. You're going to get out of the mess of the city. You're going to be closer to nature. And the reality, century and a half later, is probably far from that. Sure, you're out of the city, but you're not really any closer to nature. You're sort of robbed of any context. Your setting feels ahistorical, feels like there's nobody's lived there before. It feels abstracted from any kind of sense of location. You know, a suburb in Jacksonville, Florida will probably look just like a suburb in Sacramento, California. It robs you of any sense of context for your life. And I think we can easily do the same thing with our faith. The same temptations are there. We want to isolate ourselves from what can be a very messy history of our faith. We want to isolate ourselves from relationships that can cause hurt or can just take work in our daily lives. But the same thing that's happened to our cities is something I think that can happen to our faith. It's not sustainable. Isolation is not sustainable. It's going to make you feel, your faith feel crippled, and ultimately you're just not going to believe anymore. Now, I think a lot of us at Vox get that. I think that's not a hard sell to make. I think we understand that isolation, in terms of faith, isolation is crippling. And we want to place ourselves in some sort of historical context. In some, we want to find our place in the historical tradition. But that's much easier said than done, I think, in our current setting. I remember a couple of weeks ago in neighborhoods, we did a kind of a survey of prayer traditions. And it was really interesting. It was fascinating. But it was also very frustrating for me at the same time, because I kept thinking, what is my place in this? You know, we're sampling all these different traditions, and I was thinking, what's my tradition? You know, how do I fit into this story? You know, if you've ever read The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, it's a long sort of rambling poem that he wrote after looking at the destruction of Europe after World War I. And it's this long rambling poem where he keeps taking these quotes from all sorts of different civilizations and cultures. He takes quotes from the ancient Indian scriptures, the Rig Veda. He takes quotes from Greek poetry, Latin poetry. And it's very hard to read, and it's very, there doesn't seem to be any logical flow. And you get to the end, you've read all these different quotes from all these different old cultures, and then he says, he ends the poem by saying, "These fragments I shore against my ruin." And the picture is of this old man in some bombed out city in Europe. You know, civilization has crumbled around him, and he's just grabbing at fragments of traditions and trying to piece them back together and trying to make some sort of sense of the world that he finds himself in. That may sound very abstract to us, but I think that's really the situation that we find ourselves in. You know, we don't live in a coherent culture anymore. We live in 1,000 broken cultures. We don't feel like we live in a coherent history anymore. We feel like we're in 1,000 broken histories. And this may just sound really abstract to you or something, but all I'm saying is that I'm really confused. I don't know where my place is in history. When I read, you know, a list of people like this, I don't know how I fit into this story. How am I supposed to relate to this? What is my place in this? And I think this text offers a very clear, direct answer to that. It's not an easy answer, but it is an answer. If you look at the last verse, last two verses, 39 and 40, he's gone through this list of people who have sacrificed, who've had faith, who've accomplished a lot, who've suffered a lot, and then he says this: "And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect." And that's a really devastating turn in the text. You know, he's basically just listed all these great people, all the sacrifices they've made, and then he says, their work has come to nothing without us. And I think the idea here is their faith, all the things that they've believed in, all the things that they've suffered for, is not going to reach completion without Christ and the work of his church. In the past, we've used the picture of Mary Magdalene at the empty grave after talking to the gardener on Easter morning. And we can use that picture here if you just think of at that moment, when she was, after she had talked to the gardener, all the weight of, you know, 2,000 years of people, of prophets, of patriarchs, of everyday people, orienting themselves to this one promise, which was a lot vaguer for them than it is for us, this one promise of redemption. All these people had suffered, had staked their lives on this. And at that moment, all of that could be in vain if Mary didn't turn around and go tell somebody what she had seen at the grave. And I think that's the impetus of the text right here. We may be confused where we fit in. We may be, you know, faced with all these broken traditions, but we are given this charge, this purpose through this text, to carry that one message to the world and to finish the race that's been started a long time ago. People have suffered. People have embarrassed themselves. And it's been centuries of faith that basically is waiting on us to complete the race. I read a story, I think it was a short story from Turkey a long time ago, And it was a story about a schoolmaster, a school teacher, who he was about to retire, and he had never owned a house before, so he got this opportunity to buy into a housing co-op, a housing cooperative that they were going to build. So he put his life savings into this, and he was going to get a place in this housing co-op. And so they started construction, and while they were building, they kept digging up these antiquities. It was in Turkey. They kept digging up these columns and these statues and these arches. And the whole dilemma in the story becomes some people want to sell these antiquities to a museum and get some money off of it. But the problem is if they do that, then maybe they won't be able to build the houses. So they debate about it, and eventually they decide to use those columns and those statues that they found to actually use them in the foundations of the house that they're building. And I think I have a picture of a church that's kind of been built in the same way. But just that, I think that really illustrates the idea of using the past, using all the faith of people past in our mission. It's the faith, these people that are listed in this passage are not meant to be put on some pedestal and admired in some sort of detached way. Their story is incomplete, their work is incomplete without the work of the church. Now, you probably notice we've been throwing around the word faith quite a bit, and if you read chapter 11, it's basically used in every verse of the passage till we get to our part. And I think we have a very, very weak conception of faith, the way we talk about faith now. It's often just in terms of, you just got to believe, like you got to shut your eyes and have faith, kind of like what Kierkegaard called a leap in the dark. And it's basically we're asking ourselves to believe in something that we have no knowledge of. And that's not how faith is being talked about in this passage. That's not how it's being talked about in the New Testament. If you look at verse 1 in chapter 11, it says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." That's the translation used in the NIV and some other more recent translations. And to me, I don't know about you, but I don't really understand what that means. It sounds very vague to me. Or if I really think about it, it kind of sounds like circular logic. Like, I'm convinced, so I have faith, and so faith makes me convinced. It doesn't really, it just seems very vague. But if you look at the original Greek and some of the older English translations, the word that is now translated as assurance really means substance, the reality. And the word that's now in the NIV is translated as conviction actually means evidence. So if you step back and, stop trying to think what that means, what that statement means for your own believing, process of believing or something, if you step back and think what that statement means for how you interact with the faith of others, the faith of others is the evidence of the unseen. When we see someone else of faith, we're seeing evidence, proof of God. This past couple weeks ago, I learned that two family friends were killed in Afghanistan. They were people who, they were both Americans, but they had both basically dedicated their adult lives to Afghanistan. They were both doctors. And they got married and raised their kids in Afghanistan. And they stayed there doing their medical work. When the Soviets came, they stayed there during the civil wars. They stayed there during the Taliban regime. They've stayed there during the American invasion. And they were killed last week. But all they were doing, was just basic physical medical help with a common Afghan person. But when I step back, and look at their lives, look what drove them to do that. This verse makes sense to me. I do see evidence. I do see proof of God. And this is the only tangible proof we do have of God in our lives right now. He's not floating around in some chariot in a cloud or something that we see once in a while. The only way we can see God is through the work of others, the faith of others. And I think we need to approach it with the respect like that. And I think all of us have people like that in our lives. Maybe who, not such an exotic story, but we've all seen people who have sacrificed, who've suffered, whose life seems to have been driven by something. And I think we can all benefit from taking a step back and seeing maybe the beauty of their work. And maybe it points to a larger force that we can admire. It points to the beauty of God's creation, the beauty of God's revelation, the beauty of God's character. If you look at Hebrews chapter 3, the preacher describes us as the house of God, and the house that honors the unseen builder. And I think it's another way we can look at faith too, is when we take a step back and we start looking at the people in our lives who do seem to have genuine faith, and we start putting the pieces together, we start seeing something beautiful that does really pay tribute to the unseen builder. Last year, I took my wife to India and during the summer, and I took her to a place called the Humayun's Tomb, which is in Delhi. It's the tomb of the second Mughal emperor. It's kind of what was considered the prototype for the Taj Mahal. So I took her, and it was monsoon and in the middle of summer, and we went in the middle of the day or in the afternoon, so the hottest time. So it's like you take Austin in August and, you know, turn up the dial to 11, and that's Delhi. So we were there. We were in a rickshaw. There's pollution, you know, spewing everywhere. We were kind of tired. We got out. There's mosquitoes in the air. And we're walking along this little pathway. It's kind of cute. You know, there's some bushes around and stuff. And there's a little red sandstone archway. And we walk through the archway. And I could literally hear next to me, I could hear Linda's breath, just sucking her breath. And she saw it. And it was just beautiful. This building, just the play of the sandstone and the marble. You can't, pictures do not do it justice. It really takes your breath away. And we went in, and if you go right in the middle of the tomb, it's almost like you're in a cathedral, just the way, the height of the dome and the light inside. And there's beautiful gardens around. And it's all designed, in fact, it's kind of an idealized, supposed to be an idealized Garden of Eden. And the whole idea is that it pays tribute to the unseen builder, the unseen God. And I think that's what's in offer in this text today, that the faith of others, the promise of being in community, the promise of fighting it out, of sticking with others who have faith, is once in a while you catch a glimpse of a tribute, a glimpse of the unseen God. You get that one moment where it can take your breath away. So faith really then doesn't become a question of how much your level of belief in a certain amount of knowledge. It becomes a question of your willingness to join in the picture that you've seen, to participate in the building of the house that you've seen. It becomes a call out of apathy, a call to work, a call to be concerned. And you see this, I think this willingness, faith as a willingness to follow the call, is really best portrayed at near the end of Hebrews, where the preacher in chapter 13, he says, "So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come." And again, it's that idea of being willing to follow what you've been shown. So why should we care about the faith of others? Because it is the only way we see with our own eyes a real, a tangible picture of Christ walking to the outskirts of every city to suffer for its people. And where do we fit in? Walking behind on that very same path, with the same willingness to suffer, the same conviction as those who have walked before us and died along the way. Let's pray.